and welcome to We Are History. I'm Angela Barnes.
And I'm John O'Farrell.
He is. I can vouch for that because I can see him. John has chosen this week's episode. It is about the 1960s, probably because he can actually remember it.
Yes, I was born in the 60s, Angela. I actually remember when Britain officially went over to flared trousers. It was a very somber day when the Prime Minister came on the television to go, "This will not affect the trousers on your bottom." I remember the Beatles landing on the moon or something.
Yeah, something like that, wasn't it? Yeah.
What you Gen Xers don't understand.
Are you
actually
a boomer, John?
I'm a boomer, yeah.
You're technically a boomer.
I'm technically a boomer. It's when the, it's actually related to this.
I was thinking you were being old Gen X.
No, I'm actually a boomer. I'll explain when we talk about the pill. I think it's related to the sort of boom in the... Because when the pill came in, it's when the birth rate goes down.
Yeah, the baby boom.
So we're going to be talking about that. But then what you Gen X lot don't appreciate, Angela, is that when I was growing up, everything was in black and white. The actual concept of colour had not been invented until the swinging 60s.
Yeah, this podcast is so historically accurate, John.
So you had, you know, all grey-haired politicians in dark suits, grimy black cars, smoggy streets, grey overcoats. Then suddenly it's the 60s, Carnaby Street swinging, girls in purple and yellow miniskirts, England football team pull on red shirts, win the World Cup, Sunday newspapers print shiny colour supplements. You know, that's how it suddenly came around.
Yeah, colour TV introduced on BBC Two in 1967.
Yes, so right in the middle of the 60s. In fact, as a little scheduling joke, the first ever programme broadcast in colour on the BBC was the Black and White Minstrel Show.
Is that right? I think the BBC might have missed that there is a whole other political dimension to the concept of colour that I have just passed them by.
Different times, Angela, different times.
Oh, my goodness. I do remember thinking when I was little, though, that sort of realisation that, oh, the past wasn't in black and white.
Right.
I think I genuinely, like, it was a part of my brain that thought, you know, when my mum and dad were growing up and everything, the world was black and white because that's all you'd ever seen of that time.
Yeah.
And
no,
I'm
absolutely.
Going like, oh, no, they had bright colours then.
Yeah, but it was somehow that everything did become more colourful in the 60s. It did become like old colour TV, Habitat with its primary colours and, you know, people were less sort of modest, I suppose, about
it. Yeah, I suppose so. So anyway, this week, John is going to get all permissive on us. God, it's a bit scary. Scary thought. No more uptight, morally respectable John O'Farrell. Yeah, he's going to swear, blaspheme, probably take his clothes off.
Not again, thinks Angela. Not another court order brought by Angela Barnes. Yeah, I'm talking this week about the permissive society, how the 1960s transformed the atmosphere of the United Kingdom in a few short years that saw the legalisation of homosexuality, the legalisation of abortion, the introduction of no-fall divorce, the contraceptive pill, the abolition of censorship in the theatre, and a sexual revolution in which schoolboys from Maidenhead no longer thought sex was something to snigger and giggle about.
That last one's definitely not true, is it?
No, I still snigger and giggle at the very mention of it. I can't even say the word, Angela. I'm blushing right now. There's no escaping.
What, sex, John? Sex?
No.
Sex.
There's a lady saying sex to me. Anyway, over the course of a decade, Britain's buttoned-up Victorian prudery and censorship, it was sort of really rapidly loosened, and a whole string of liberal reforms helped sort of create an atmosphere of tolerance and honesty that finally acknowledged that, yes, people had sex out of marriage. And
no,
yes,
they didn't, John.
Some people were homosexual.
No.
And other people might like to see naked people on stage or choose to read literature that, you know, other people might seem obscene. Or that some people like to keep Polaroids of themselves performing fellatio on Douglas Fairbanks Jr. and Conservative Minister Duncan Sands. Oh, that last one's just the Duchess of Argyll, apparently.
Well, yeah, we've touched on that before, I think. The divorce of the Duke and Duchess of Argyll was a great upper-class sex scandal of the 60s. The infamous Polaroid photos were used as evidence in the couple's divorce case. And because before the divorce reforms of 1969, which, again, we talked about in our marriage episode, a couple couldn't divorce unless there was proof of adultery by one or both parties. So thousands of people were trapped in failed marriages because they didn't have saucy Polaroids like the Duchess of Argyll. You see, this is it. The rich get the, because they could afford a Polaroid camera.
Yeah, or they would go and stay in a hotel and say, look, somebody saw me going to this hotel with this woman, and they'd actually sleep in
separate
rooms.
They used to pay women. We've mentioned it before. Yeah. But they used to pay women to go to a hotel with them and be photographed so that they could get
the divorce.
Exactly.
So that's, that's me. I'm going to tick off divorce reform in this episode.
Yeah, we've done that. We've covered it before. Listen to our marriage reform episode.
There's four or five other key moments that helped usher in the permissive society.
So were these liberalisations of the 1960s the result of specific legislation by the government here in Britain, or was it something that was just happening all around the world anyway?
Well, I think sort of both, really. But I would say that it happened much sooner and faster here because of the reforming Labour government that was elected in 1964 and the sort of dexterity and determination of the Home Secretary, Roy Jenkins. There is no way that the same laws would have been passed if the crusty old Tory, Alec Douglas-Hume, had won the 64 election.
Knew this was going to happen. This is just propaganda for the Labour Party in the run-up to a general election, isn't it, John?
Obviously.
You made me complicit in this now, shameless propaganda.
Obviously, I'm biased. But, Angela, I don't mind knocking the Labour Party when it's called for. That Labour government was a disappointment to many on the left, and Roy Jenkins took a terrible wrong turn later in his career.
Because he left the Labour Party. Wow, you really don't mind criticising the Labour Party, do you? Well, that Labour minister made a terrible mistake when he left the Labour Party. Yes, John O'Farrell.
I was not a supporter of the SDP, of which Roy Jenkins was a founding member in 82. But as Home Secretary in the 1960s, he was very effective in difficult circumstances, and he was very famously a radical reformer.
Do I take it he had trouble saying his R's, John?
Roy Jenkins, they called
him. Cheap jokes,
political
John.
Satire. It's very unsophisticated back then.
So, John, how far are we going to go back? Because you know me, like a bit of context.
Well, if we're studying the 1960s, Ash, I thought we might go way, way back to the 1950s. So very stuffy conservative decade in which Britain was ruled by an old Harrovian, followed by an old Etonian, and then another old Etonian.
Is the alarm going to go off?
Thank God those days of being ruled by upper-class, privately educated males is far behind.
It couldn't happen today. Woo, woo, woo. Yep. This is a satire you listen for, isn't it? You see, we pretend it's a history podcast, but it's got some really cutting-edge comedy about current affairs thrown in if you listen really carefully.
At the beginning of the 1960s, this country still had a very deferential attitude to the upper classes, to the government and royalty. There was a sort of presumption, publicly at least, that they knew better and had a right to rule over us.
Yeah, I mean, behind the scenes, people were probably as cynical and suspicious of authority as they have been since prehistory. But we're talking about the things that were said in public, in the media and all that.
Yeah, and I think that probably had a bearing on what people actually thought as well. I remember, for example, my parents in the 80s being shocked at my suggestion that the British police would ever deliberately lie or tamper with evidence. I was telling them all about the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four, and they were going, oh, I'm sure it's just one or two bad apples.
These are your lefty parents.
They were my lefty parents, but they'd swallowed the idea of the British police were the best in the world because they'd been told it so many times.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'll go back to, say, 1956, for the first glimmers of change. It was the year of Suez, of course.
Yeah, check out our episode on that particular disaster for how the public started to worry that their leaders might not be so competent and honest after all.
Yeah, and it was the year of Look Back in Anger and The Angry Young Men. It was the year Elvis Presley burst on the scene and Allen Ginsberg and the Beat Poets were making their mark in the USA.
Is this a sort of undercurrent building, isn't there? For the first time since the war, really.
Yeah, a whole cultural thing which is happening at the same time as the actual changes in the law. But those are the milestones that I was going to focus on in this episode. So the first one I want to do, Angela, is not an act of parliament, but a court ruling.
Okay.
So in 1960 came the famous Lady Chatterley trial.
Yeah, in 1960, the publishing house Penguin Books decided to publish an unexpurgated version of D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover. This book had been banned since the 20s, of course, although bowdlerised versions have been published. Do you want to explain what bowdlerised means? People might not know.
It means sort of censored,
edited,
naughty bits taken out.
Yeah, the good bits taken out.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was named after somebody called Bowdler, who did Victorian versions of King Lear, where it wins Happily Ever After, and it's like a rom-com.
That's right, yeah. They just take out all the bits that might disturb
people.
Society.
Yes, yeah. But anyway, in 1960, Penguin decided to test this law. As well as being the 75th anniversary of D.H. Lawrence's birth, it was also Penguin's 25th Jubilee, and a run of 200,000 copies was printed to mark the occasion.
So this is quite a statement by Penguin. They weren't just putting a few copies into foils and seeing what happened.
Under the Act passed in 1959, actually, it was a criminal offence to publish literature classed as obscene. So the Crown made the decision to prosecute Penguin.
What, the Netflix TV show?
Yeah, that's right. They all gathered around. It was a bad impression of Princess Margaret. Actually, no, Princess Margaret is great. I take that back, Leslie Manville. You're wonderful. The Crown, I mean, the CPS, I suppose, made the decision to prosecute Penguin and block the publication of Lady Chatterley's Lover. and Penguin for the prosecution.
And of course, this became a fascinating test for the morality of the day, the freedom of speech versus the Victorian morality that had held sway for so long in the 20th century.
Yeah, of course, the papers loved alluding to all the rude bits that they weren't allowed to print, but could
look
hint at
this, isn't this terrible? Yes, they said this word for word.
Exactly. They could hint at it on the pretext of covering an important legal test case.
Yeah.
I think the most famous line for the trial belonged to their prosecuting counsel. His name was Mervyn Griffiths Jones. Angela, I'll let you be the posh barrister on this one.
Yeah, out of the two of us, I am the obvious one to play the posh barrister. You're absolutely right.
Give us your posh barrister, Angela.
Would you approve of your young sons, young daughters, because girls can read as well as boys, reading this book? Is it a book you would have lying around your own house? Is it a book that you would even wish your wife or your servants to read?
That was the line.
So it's really
got
in touch with the people.
Absolutely, yeah. We're lying around for your... Angela, do you leave books lying around for your servants?
Yeah, I do. It's mostly about, you know, how to clean your home.
Yeah, well, it prompted scorn because how out of touch, you know, could the ruling classes be in post-war Britain? Yeah.
Yeah, he also alleged that the novel induced lustful thoughts in the minds of those who read it.
I'm sure he spent...
Did you, mate?
Yeah, I'm sure he spent a lot of time rereading the bits that caused lustful thoughts, just to be really sure. But anyway, Penguin won the case and the book was reprinted and sold in huge numbers.
And of course, that then opened the door for a tidal wave of naughty books that were perhaps not of the literary merit that D.H. Lawrence had.
Yes, quite. And I think we quoted this Philip Larkin poem in an earlier podcast.
I think
podcast.
We have, yes. Yeah.
But it's very appropriate for this episode.
Do you want me to do it.
Yeah. You be Philip Larkin.
It's sexual intercourse began in 1963, which was rather late for me, between the end of the Chatterley Ban and the Beatles' first LP.
Yeah, I think we did it in our Perfumo trial episode,
might,
actually, which
so
was the
definitely
very first,
done it before.
First one we put out.
Yeah.
And it was the same barrister, actually, who prosecuted Stephen Ward that represented the Crown in the Lady Chatterley trial.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So without repeating the whole of the Profumo scandal episode, it did do a lot to demonstrate that the upper classes were not as upstanding and moral as they would have us believe. And it's always been the case that they like to set the moral standards but don't behave by them.
Yeah.
And the hypocrisy of those making moral judgments over us started to be exposed. Really.
Exactly. So the next big milestone was the arrival of the contraceptive pill. Now, again, we've done a whole episode on contraception. Who can forget alligator dung?
Yes, a lot of listeners got in touch after that episode, John, to say thanks for the tip. And they're now using alligator dung themselves as their preferred form of contraception.
Glad we're hoping to help listeners. So in the context of the changing atmosphere of the country, the arrival of the pill was a massive change. It was introduced by Enoch Powell, believe it or not.
It's not someone you usually associate with progressive causes, is it?
No, it's not. You know, he just happened to be the health minister at the time. But following its successful rollout in the United States in 1960, the following year, it was approved for prescription to married women only.
Well, obviously, John, I mean, what possible use could single women have for a contraceptive pill? It would just be a waste.
Exactly. Otherwise, it would encourage all sorts of improper behaviour and unthinkable nasty sordidness and horrid filthiness.
Absolutely. And it was at the discretion of doctors whether they should prescribe this new wonder drug. So probably mostly male doctors
at
that time. So doctors tended to approve it for older women who already had several children. Because if you're a young married woman without children, well, obviously you should be getting pregnant as soon as possible. That is indeed the whole point of view. And do you know what? I'll just chip in here a bit because there's still that attitude a little bit. Like I remember there was a period in my 30s, early 30s, and I have always sort of known that I don't want to have children. Yep. And I would go to a GP, and it was never a female GP that ever did this to me. It was only ever a male GP.
Yeah.
And it's happened to me several times. You go to a GP about something completely unrelated with reproduction or anything to do with that. And they'd say, by the way, you know, I noticed that you're on the contraceptive pill. You know, you are, if you were to have a child now, you'd be a geriatric mother. Just say, if you are thinking of having a family. And they would just bring it up out of nowhere. And it would make me so angry.
Thanks for your lifestyle advice.
How dare you? So, I'm not coming about that.
So do you think the doctors back then were not socially liberal young women? Would be your analysis
of the 60s?
Yes, John,
we are saying that, yes.
The pill was developed by scientists in the United States, but the first trials were conducted in Puerto Rico. And when I first read this, I thought, oh, yeah, so they wouldn't get sued if all the women had terrible side effects or dropped down dead. But also it's because The United States proper had very restrictive laws about promoting anything relating to sex or contraception.
I can't say I'm surprised when you look at what's happening now. But yeah, since 1837, America's so-called Comstock laws criminalised the use of the postal service as a means of sending, obtaining or possessing items considered obscene or salacious, including books, pamphlets, anything used to facilitate sex, inverted commas,
yes,
or containing sexual language or whatever. And the Comstock laws thus basically criminalise contraceptive devices because they facilitate sex.
Yeah. So they did the first trials in Puerto Rico where this didn't apply.
Yeah.
And then by the 1950s, the laws were starting to be repealed in various states and they could actually start testing the pill on American women as well as Puerto Ricans. And it was in December 1961 that the pill was approved in the UK. I was conceived about 6 months before that.
Oh, interesting. So if they'd just been a little bit quicker with it, if the pill had been available 6 months earlier, I don't know who I'd be doing this podcast with, but it wouldn't be you.
Yeah, you'd have to do a history podcast with some other old history nerd, Andrew. Probably David Starkey.
Oh, God, no.
Amazing. It was only 6 years after its initial introduction that the pill was allowed to be prescribed to unmarried women in 1967. The summer love. Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's quite a shift in attitudes in a short time.
Quite a short time, isn't it? That's sort of six years.
Sort of demonstrates how fast the old certainties were crumbling, I'd say.
Yeah, without wishing to suggest that every listener born before the mid-60s was an unwanted accident like John. The baby boom, the sort of post-war baby boom, peaks at exactly the point at which the use of the pill becomes widespread.
Yeah.
And then after that, women were the ones in charge of preventing pregnancy. They had agency over that. And the line on the graph, surprise, surprise, rapidly declines.
That's why I'm a boomer, Angela, and not a Gen X. So my generation born in the 60s remains by far the largest demographic age group. But now this bulge in the population is gradually heading towards old age and retirement without having thought it through about savings or pensions. Frankly,
yeah, but all your houses cost 50p, so you'll be all right.
We're sort of counting on the rest of you to give us an enormous comfort, Angela, when we retire. I have planned for my future. I have told my children that I'm going to be an enormous burden to them. While they cough on their tea and cope with that, we'll take a break and we'll come back and talk about the next milestones in the permissive society. We'll see you after this break.
Welcome back to We Are History, where we are talking about the permissive society. It was John's idea. He's a pervert. So
thank you for that.
That year that the pill became available to all women, 1967, that was also the key year for two more milestones on the road to modern social attitudes.
Yeah.
The Sexual Offences Bill, which finally legalised homosexuality, and the Abortion Act, which, as you've probably already guessed, made abortion legal in Great Britain.
Yeah, before this landmark act, legal abortions could be secured if you had the money to go to Harley Street and pay a doctor to say that the patient's well-being would be harmed by the continuation of the pregnancy. But obviously, as always, for working class women, an illegal backstreet abortion was the only alternative.
Absolutely. If you haven't seen the film Dirty Dancing, by the way, people think that that's a... I don't know, have you seen it, John, Dirty Dancing?
I don't think I have, actually.
But it's such a great film. People think, oh, it's some girly film about dancing. And it really isn't. It's a real social commentary of the 60s in America. And because there's a character in it that has a backstreet abortion. And it's really gritty and really, you know, shows how the person who made her pregnant just didn't care, you know, got away with it. Anyway, watch Dirty Dancing. It's a great film. It's estimated that well over 100,000 women a year were risking their lives through this horrific practice. Some claimed it was as high as 250,000. But what we do know for certain was that around 35,000 women a year were being treated on the NHS because of illegal amateur abortions that had gone badly wrong.
Wow, that's terrifying.
That's so many.
That's so shocking, isn't it?
But actually, what it makes you see is that the sort of motivation for bringing in this legislation wasn't just the rights of women.
It
was money. It was the financial burden on the NHS.
Yeah,
but also,
it was all about we've got to stop these backstreet abortions. They didn't even try and argue is a fetus a human being? They didn't go there. They went, these things are happening. We've got to make it safe and legal.
Yeah.
In fact, you talk about Dirty Dancing. At the time, a backstreet abortion was represented in the hugely popular Michael Caine film Alfie, which is sort of a swinging London film, but it did a bit to reignite the debate around the issue. So the young Liberal MP, David Steele, was encouraged to introduce a private member's bill widening the availability of abortions, and Roy Jenkins ensured that the bill got all the support that he could provide, short of a three-line whip. And Steele was only 29 at the time, which is pretty impressive, isn't it?
Yeah, really impressive.
There'd already been, to help encourage this debate, there'd already been a royal commission chaired by John Peel.
What? Wait, not that John Peel.
I'm thinking probably not, Angela. Now, before the report from the Royal College of Obstetricians, here's the fall with Totally Wired. No, this one was Sir John Peel, so probably not the Radio 1 DJ and champion of indie punk bands.
I guess they had to go through the charade of a royal commission to look like they were taking the objections of the opponents seriously.
Yeah.
You can't just legalise abortion one day and expect the Archbishop of Canterbury to go, all right, no problem. I thought that was probably coming. Go ahead.
So the Act made it lawful to have an abortion up to the 28th week if two registered medical practitioners believed in good faith that the continuance of the pregnancy would involve risk to the life of the pregnant woman or harm her physical or mental health or that of any of her family members.
Still quite restrictive.
But there were plenty of people who fought to have the cutoff point much earlier than the 28th week. And it put the decision into the hands of doctors, removing the police from the equation. And the criterion of harming the mother's mental health was wide enough justification to allow thousands of abortions to go ahead. 37,000 in the first year after the Act was passed.
Yeah, and that, I suppose, the mother's mental health or that of family members or whatever, that's quite a wide, you could justify that in many ways, I guess. I'm guessing none of this had been in Labour's 1966 manifesto.
No, of course it had. Not a single mention of abortion or rights for homosexuals. They had an election to win, Angela, and to try and secure a working majority after the tiny majority they'd won a couple of years earlier.
I guess Sir Harold Wilson was too canny a politician to frighten all the old people and the Christians with all this shocking permissive stuff.
Yeah, I think it's a sort of a reminder that people expecting all these progressive promises from Keir Starmer before the next election might look back and see how cautious the most successful Labours have generally been before they've won power.
Yeah, John, you're doing propaganda again. But you're right. It is that thing, you know, people go, oh, why is he not coming out saying this? Yeah. Why is he not? It's because we need him to win an election.
Because
if he says those things out loud, we're going to
lose. Yeah.
Tories in power forever.
Even though Labour won a large majority after the 66 election, these measures were actually put through as free votes following private members' bills. The government made sure there was enough time to get the bills properly debated and voted upon, but they didn't whip their MPs or risk divisions or rebellions with issues like abortion or homosexuality that back then were highly emotive and divided every political party, probably every dinner party too.
Yeah. So this was how they legalised homosexuality as well?
Yeah, in fact, that was long overdue. But way back in 1957, the Wolfenden Report had recommended legalising homosexuality, but successive Conservative Home Secretaries had failed to act on this. They were worried about alienating their political base, or they just found the whole thing too distasteful to spend any time on. In fact, Wolfenden himself, Lord Wolfenden, was disgusted by what he then called queers. He hated being associated with it, even though his own son was gay.
Maybe because his own son was gay.
Yeah. So let's go back a little bit, Angela, because I know you love that.
Yeah.
Henry VIII, I'm going to go back to now.
Wow.
It was Henry VIII who had made buggery punishable by death. Which seems a bit harsh to me, really. I mean, you could just say, it's not really my cup of tea.
It's not hurting anyone else if they're consenting adults. Yeah. No one's saying you have to do it. And then in 1885, the Victorians passed the Criminal Law Amendment Act. We talked about this quite a lot in the Glamour Boys episode which, among some quite progressive measures, like raising the age of consent for girls from 13 to 16, went and spoiled it by making an offence out of gross indecency between males. Of course, that's quite ambiguous.
That could cover whatever you wanted, really, couldn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a load of football fans with their shirts off doing bad singing, in my book, that's gross indecency between males. But that's how, you know, just by writing letters.
Absolutely.
Under that.
Yeah, more whatever the police want to do you for. So it was the 1885 Act, actually, that was used to send Oscar Wilde to Reading Jail for the love that dare not speak its name. And then Alan Turing was also prosecuted under that law, of course.
So it's quite widely believed, and I've certainly heard this before, that lesbians were not included in the act because Queen Victoria had that part of the bill taken out because she didn't believe that lesbians even existed.
Yes.
Is that true? Or is that one of those myths that we just like to believe?
Well, I actually researched that because I used to believe that because I heard it so often, but unfortunately, it is a myth.
Right.
No such legislation ever came before Victoria, and she was not in the habit of changing laws in any case. No monarch really did that after the end of the Stuart era when Queen Anne died in 1714, and she definitely would have believe that lesbians existed.
Absolutely. So in 1965, an opinion poll found that 63% of respondents did not believe that homosexuality should be a crime, while only 36% agreed that it should. So that's quite a, you know,
that was in the mail as well.
Wow. Although 93% agreed that homosexual men were in need of medical or psychiatric treatment. So there's this, no, we shouldn't criminalise it, we should treat it.
Exactly. I mean, the whole term of the debate surrounding the Sexual Offences Act in 1967 seems ludicrous today. Even the supporters of rights for gay men talked of them as poor, diseased individuals who already had this terrible burden to suffer without being criminalised as well. And then most members of the Conservative Party were appalled at the suggestion that homosexuality be made available to all. They'd always had to pay good money to send their kids to exclusive boarding schools for that.
Yeah, quite. Yeah, I mean, the anti-reform position was basically that homosexuality is an illness and the best possible cure is to lock them up with lots of other men.
Exactly, yeah.
Brilliant.
To quote the Earl of Dudley, homosexuals are the most disgusting people in the world. Prison is much too good a place for them. In fact, that is a place where many of them would like to go for obvious reasons.
Jesus
God, terrible.
This is not as long ago as I wish it was.
I know, I know. It's my lifetime, you know. So the MP who pushed hardest for the reform was Labour backbencher Leo Absey. He deserves a big shout out. Roy Jenkins made sure that his private member's bill got debated. The terms of the bill were still incredibly restrictive. The age of consent for homosexual men was set at 21, 5 years higher than for heterosexual sex. Gay sex was not illegal if it was in private behind closed doors. But even if other people were at that address, a gay couple could still be committing an offence.
That's mad, isn't it? In fact, police harassment of homosexuals increased massively during the years after the bill. So it came with a backlash.
Yeah.
And after the bill was passed, Lord Arran said, "I ask those homosexuals to show their thanks by comporting themselves quietly and with dignity. Any form of ostentatious behaviour now or in the future or any form of public flaunting would be utterly distasteful."
I don't think we'll be sitting down at Vauxhall Tavern on Saturday night.
No, quite. Yeah. So modern day campaigners have criticised the timidity of this milestone act, but it's hard to understand just how extreme the prejudice was just 55 years ago.
Yeah.
And even with tireless lobbying and major concessions, the bill was only passed by one vote.
That's incredible. One vote in it. For me, it's a perfect example of making change happen incrementally. If they had demanded an age of consent at 16 or extended the provisions of the bill to Scotland, where MPs were much more religious and conservative, with a small c, then the bill would never have passed and the cause of equality would have been set back. Mm. So often in history, the struggle for equality starts with getting just a little less inequality and then using that to carry on the good fight.
Yeah, absolutely. Interestingly, Harold Wilson's own 800-page book on his Labour government of the 60s makes no mention of the legislation of homosexuality or abortion.
Yeah.
Just like it didn't happen.
Yeah.
Which makes you think that he wasn't particularly proud of those changes.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
impetus for change was coming from his Home Secretary.
Yeah, I think Wilson himself was a bit of a prude. Actually, when the pop group The Move, the manager promoted their single Flowers in the Rain with a cheeky postcard showing a naked Harold Wilson with his political assistant Marcia Faulkner. Mm. Wilson sued them and he won.
Wow.
And he stipulated that the royalties from the record be given to charity. And over the decades, that joke postcard stunt cost Ronnie Wood and the rest of the band around £1 million in royalties.
Wow.
One stupid little gag. You can imagine it, can't
you?
Yeah. We interrupt this podcast to bring you some breaking news.
How often do you have to do breaking news in a history podcast? This has got to be a first, isn't it?
Do you remember how we said Harold Wilson was outraged at the constant innuendo and gossipy suggestions that he was having an affair with his political secretary, Marcia Faulkner?
Yeah, well, turns out it was fair enough because he wasn't. He was having an affair with his deputy press secretary, Janet Hewlett-Davies.
Yeah, that only came out just after we recorded this episode. So that's April 2024.
So that scandal is Harold Wilson's political career finished. I mean, there's no coming back from that.
We'll bring you more breaking news as we get it. So, yeah, for his liberal approach to social issues, Roy Jenkins became a bogey figure for the conservative right and for policemen and prison officers. They were shocked at this namby-pamby liberal refuse to authorise the birching of prisoners, appalled when capital punishment was suspended for 5 years in 65 before it was finally abolished in 1969.
The ending of stage censorship was seen as just another example of how the country was going to the dogs. Yes. Before long, shows like Oh Calcutta and Hair would make the most of the chance to incorporate gratuitous nudity that needed to be checked out to see just how gratuitous yes. it was. And you like a bit of gratuitous nudity in this podcast. It was weird on a podcast, but you know. Yeah.
It's just very hot in here, Angela. It's just very hot. It was 1968, actually, when the Theatres Act finally abolished the role of the Lord Chamberlain deciding.
That's from Shakespearean, Elizabethan times.
Yeah, what could and could not be performed in the British theatres. I think it actually goes back to Walpole. There might have been, he might have formalised it.
Yeah, we've talked about it in earlier episodes, but ever since the time of Robert Walpole, theatres were censored by this particular officer of the royal household. And if he decided he didn't want something on the stage, he could just refuse them permission to perform it. Have you watched Upstart Crow?
Yes.
Yeah, because there's Lord Chamberlain's role in that. You know, yes. That's okay, everything he writes.
Yeah, yeah. That's funny, yeah. And in the 60s, this wasn't some old quaint law that was still on the statutes, but was widely ignored. Right into the 60s, the Lord Chamberlain was interfering in the content of theatrical productions. I mean, it's bad enough having Bob Geldof telling you to change your music. Musical Angela. But there was one show back then on the Edinburgh Fringe in the 1960s about the stealing of the crown jewels. And he just wrote them a one-line letter telling them to remove that particular aspect of the story. And that was basically the whole show. So they just couldn't perform what they had written.
Censorship is just, pure censorship. The abolition came about after pressure from prominent theatre professionals who suffered at the random judgments of the Lord Chamberlain, particularly Ken Tynan.
Yes, Ken Tynan actually made his mark on the decade in another way. He became the first person to say fuck on British television.
George, you can't say that.
I've said it in my podcast. He said it on a late night discussion programme and it prompted a formal apology from the BBC, three separate Commons motions and a suggestion from Mary Whitehouse that he should have his bottom smacked.
Yeah, but it later turned out that Tynan was quite into flagellation, so that wouldn't have been much of a disincentive anyway.
Yes, yes. So Mary Whitehouse was part of the backlash against the Permissive Society. Mm. The National Viewers and Listeners Association was launched in 1965 out of the Clean Up TV campaign.
There was also the Christian Festival of Light campaign led by Malcolm Muggeridge and Lord Longford, which attempted to create a mass movement of Christian evangelicals opposed to the Permissive Society. But frankly, people were too busy having premarital sex or reading smutty books to take much notice.
And with that thought in my head, we'll take another break and while I cool down a bit, and we'll come back to the final bit about the Permissive Society. See you in a bit.
Hello and welcome back to, I forgot the name of the podcast. Do you know what? John and I, in that break, we talked about, I recorded the Now Show last night and John came along to watch it.
Yeah.
So I almost said hello and welcome back to the Now Show. And then realised that we're not doing the Now Show. We are history. We are history, Angela. We are history. That's what you're doing. And we are talking about the Permissive Society. And by the late 60s, there was a decidedly different atmosphere in the country and in the arts and culture of Great Britain. Won't include Northern Ireland because most of this didn't apply to them. And Ireland's idea of permissive back then was letting a lady into a pub.
Yes, the Permissive Society seemed all pervasive and soon the entire nation was convinced that just about everyone except them was having endless, instant, uncomplicated sex. Young men were able to say to attractive women that celibacy and monogamy and all that shit, they're just social constructs, man. You chicks should just sleep with guys like me all the time, especially you two Scandinavian twins. I personally volunteer to liberate you from the fascist patriarchy that tells you you shouldn't have sex with me whenever I suggest it.
Yeah, women's rights still had a long way to go.
Yeah.
The Equal Pay Act was passed in 1969, but Labour lost power in 1970, and in fact it wasn't enforced until they got back again in 1974.
Yep.
The first national conference of the British Women's Liberation Movement was held at Ruskin College in 1970,
yeah.
And the first issue of Spare Rib, the Women's Liberation magazine, was published in 1972.
Yeah, one thing I'd say about all this, Angela, for the frankly rather tiresome talk of how incredible the 60s were, it has to be remembered that for most people, they weren't.
My mum always says that. My mum's like, I wasn't living the swinging 60s. Yeah. I was working as a, you know, secretary or whatever, and just coming home.
Yeah, watch the film Cares. You know, it's like Miners and council flats and outside toilets. Most of the younger generation were not experimenting with pot in a groovy flat in the King's Road. Yeah. And most students were not dropping out of the LSC to march against the Vietnam War and then setting up modernist cooperatives that revolutionised LP cover art and British furniture design.
Yeah, for millions of teenagers in the 60s, the grooviest thing that happened to them was leaving school at 15 and then getting a boring, low-paid job in a factory.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I'll never forget that mind-blowing experience that summer of 67, man. It was like, I was going down this tunnel and, wow, there were like all these lights at the end, like bobbing around on people's heads. And that's when I realised I got a job as a coal miner and I was going to spend the rest of my life down the pit. Exactly. That's really what the 60s was like for most people.
Yeah.
It's probably one of the golden rules of history that if you hear about some golden age when everyone's swept along by crazy hedonistic euphoria, you can be sure it's in fact just the privileged minority.
You lived in the right place.
Drinking cocktails and doing the Charleston in the 20s or freaking out at free festivals in the 60s.
Yeah.
So that's the permissive society, Angela. Have I made you feel liberated from the stuffy 1950s prudery and censorship?
Oh,
would your dad, Angela, have been able to run a sex shop without the Labour government of the 1960s?
Well, and would I be here, John, because my dad's shop gave me a lot of material in my early days as a stand-up comedian.
Yes. Well, thank you. Thank you, Roy Jenkins, for your effort. My research for this book was 60s Britain by Mark Donnelly. But I did bring with me lots of the research that I did for my own history of modern Britain. So all the books I read for that, I thank all those authors as well. That book was what prompted you to get in touch with me in the first place and suggest we do a podcast together.
Yeah, and that's quite poignant, John, because we've got a little bit of an announcement about that, haven't we?
Yes, we have. After well over 100 episodes, Angela and I have decided to put this podcast to a grisly medieval death.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say it's a sad day, but this will be the last episode of We Are History.
We love doing it, but it just takes us so much time to do it properly, and we've both got lots of other things going on. So we've decided that We Are History has met its Waterloo. Like the Roman Empire, all good things have to come to an end.
Was the Roman Empire a good thing, John?
Oh, that's an interesting debate. Maybe we should do a podcast about that.
Yeah, we can't, John. We're not doing it anymore, remember?
Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah. We've loved getting so much feedback from all our listeners, the great reviews and the encouraging comments.
The ones that say John speaks too fast.
That's absolutely scandalous and libelous, and I do not speak too fast.
Listen, we are sad to be wrapping this up, and I hope you understand why. Thank you, but the shows will still be up there on your favourite platform for you to listen to, revisit, recommend to friends, etc. There's over 100 of them. If you're anything like me, if you've got to the end, you'll have forgotten the first one anyway. So just keep doing that forever on a loop.
Yeah.
But we just haven't got the time in our schedules to make more of them, unfortunately. As much as we love doing it, and John and I love working together, it is so much work to research, write, and make this particular sort of podcast.
Yeah. Patreon supporters, thank you for your regular support. It means a lot that you are prepared to make a payment every month to keep us going. Don't worry, we won't keep taking your money indefinitely.
Are we not, John?
Any decade now, those payments should stop.
We do really appreciate the Patreon support, and that did help us keep it going actually longer than we thought we could.
Yeah.
We've got such a hardcore, brilliant listeners who give us really nice feedback, and you know, it's really nice. But unfortunately, we can't justify the amount of time it takes to make this podcast. We can't make it make sense with our other work.
Yeah,
anymore.
We don't have researchers. We don't have people writing notes for us.
We do all of it ourselves.
And
the people we do have, though, on our team, we want to say a really big thank you to them. And that's the producers that we've worked with. It's the brilliant Simon Williams, the wonderful Anne-Marie Luff, and before we came to Podmasters, Spike Aylward, who produced our early episodes.
Yes.
We've got some Patreon subscribers to do a shout out to.
Yep. Thank you, Hannah.
A clever cat.
All right, good.
Wow, they're really clever cat. They managed to join a Patreon.
David Andrews.
Rebecca Warren.
And Julie, whoever you are, Julie.
Thank you so much. And thank you to all our Patreon supporters, of course.
And all our listeners who've given us nice reviews. But Angela, it's been a pleasure and a privilege. Maybe we'll come back and find a less time-consuming way to do a podcast together. But for now, we say thank you for listening.
So that's it from We Are History Now. We really are history. Thank you. I feel a bit emotional, John. It's been really fun. And we will work together again on something. You know, tell people on the telly that run telly that we'd like to do a telly thing together. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
That's enough. Get off the stage. It's over. The lights have gone out. The audience are shuffling for
hello?
Yesterday.
Hello, is this thing on?
Bye.
Goodbye.
We Are History was written and presented by Angela Barnes and John O'Farrell. The producer was me, Simon Williams. The group editor was Andrew Harrison. Socials were by Kieran Leslie. And artwork was by James Parrott. We Are History is a Podmasters production.